Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Chris Hutton. Today's episode, we're going to be covering South Africa's foreign policy, Eskom desperately clinging on to its monopoly over distribution, and political violence, particularly in the Eastern Cape. Let's start off with some comments from US President Donald Trump, who said that he might skip the Group of 20 G20 Leaders Summit in South Africa in November and send someone else to represent the US. Saying, quote, "I think maybe I'll send somebody else because I have a lot of problems with South Africa. They have some very bad policies," he told reporters on Air Force One when asked about this. I decided to save everyone from doing a Trump impression there, which I was very tempted to do. But anyway, this kind of contradicts what Ramaphosa has been saying about Trump's attendance at the G20 summit. Back in May, after their contentious meeting with each other, Ramaphosa said that Trump had agreed that the U.S. should continue playing a key role in the G20, including attending the G20 Leaders Summit in Johannesburg later this year, where South Africa is going to be handing over the presidency of the G20 to the U.S. Now, I think this is a particularly big deal for Ramaphosa because he is very attached, it seems, to the sort of prestige and the legacy aspects of the G20 summit and hosting a successful one here. And despite many assurances by the ANC that the US was warming up to us and was going to play ball with the G20 summit, it really doesn't seem like it's going to be the case. Senior officials from the US government have been notably absent at various G20 meetings so far. And it's unclear what Trump's final decision will be. Currently, it doesn't seem like he's going to show up. So, Chris, firstly, let's start off with that. What are your thoughts on that issue?
Yeah, so I guess confirmation that we at the CRA and at the Institute have been highlighting, not only after the meeting in the White House, but in the first sort of 6 months of President Trump's second administration, in the lead up to the elections last year, that the breakdown in the relationship has been coming for a long time and been spurred on at various points from the South African side. You recently had the passing through the House committee of the Jackson Bill, and that was also voted on by 7 Democrats in favor. So it's not just in one particular party. So despite some of, I think, the hopium after the White House meeting that perhaps things had been, it had been better than had been the worst case scenario imagined, there haven't been substantive enough moves from the South African side on non-trade matters to bring any kind of different discussion or attention in the White House and for President Trump and those immediately around him in his cabinet. When they discuss South African issues, when it comes up, when especially now the G20, given that South Africa is the host, when it comes up, they have formed their view based on the evidence they've seen, based on people they've interacted with, based on, I think, their own intelligence in South Africa as well, that they don't buy what the ANC is selling anymore from both a domestic policy point of view and also South Africa's foreign policy, which remains very much in the hands of the ANC exclusively. So I think President Trump, as he's doing with the threats of reciprocal tariffs, it is one of his many negotiating tools in both trade and other matters. So he's going to continue using the possibility that he might or might not attend the G20 summit up until probably the very last minute to see how South Africa deals with it and how South Africa reacts. It's also, there isn't really that much to lose for him in not attending. What is the impetus on him? What is the leverage that South Africa is trying to, you know, leverage in the positive and negative sense, in a negotiating sense, trying to apply to convince him that it's to his benefit, to the US's benefit, to attend the summit? So South Africa's sort of foreign policy moves, especially towards the US, once again exposed, despite how President Ramaphosa tries to spin things, I think, quite well. Where it's interesting, he never takes questions from the media with most of his sort of events, as it were, his family meetings. But when a foreign leader, you know, puts him on the spot and puts his own position forward, it exposes just how much South Africa has caused damage with its foreign policy moves, as it were.
So one of the people meant to fix the relationship with the U.S. Is the president's special envoy to North America, Tlebisi Jonas, who it turned out quite recently, it came out that he was denied a visa by the U.S. and was never able to go at all. So one wonders what he's been doing. Well, we have some idea of what he was doing. He gave a talk to the Katlema Motlanthe Foundation Winter Seminar on Growth and Transformation, which is reproduced in an edited form on the Daily Maverick. And he said some interesting things talking about South Africa's foreign policy. He was kind of giving a broad overview of how he, and I suspect some parts of the ANC, view the global situation. He said, global growth is now tilted decisively towards Asia and other emerging centers. The concentration of global capital is rebalancing towards Europe and China. He said that demographic, economic, and monetary base of the world is shifting away from the Western alliance, and a new architecture is needed to govern economic and financial relations. He went on to say that non-aligned countries have a key role to play in this, as there's increasing global tension between China and the U.S., with many manufacturing firms wanting to move away from places like China and instead moving to places like Vietnam and other sort of countries that are seen as not entirely aligned. Interestingly, he includes South Africa in this block of non-aligned countries, which I think is key for where this goes wrong. He said the U.S. remains a central player in global development. South Africa's relationship with the U.S. is not merely transactional, but based on a long partnership rooted in shared values of democracy, justice, and progress. In immediate terms, South Africa is engaged with negotiations to reach a solution to the tariff impasse that benefits both parties. More generally, we remain committed to negotiating through the immediate relational crisis. There is opportunity for collaboration on issues of mutual interest and concern, such as negotiating lasting solutions to major conflict zones in the world. South Africa is a non-aligned strategic middle power balancing national economic interests, upholding the principles of democracy, human rights, social justice, and is committed to the cause of Africa's development. He also then attacked what he called ideological cliques, partisan political factions, cabals of business people with their own commercial agendas, exerting pressure on us and seeking to extort us, and that South Africa must unite together and stop being so divided when it comes to a response to the US. Some thoughts on this one. Firstly, it's a good point to say that as a non-aligned country, you stand to benefit from being able to do both business with the US and China. Here's the problem. Despite the government's many protests that we are non-aligned, we are most definitely not non-aligned. We do military exercises with China and Russia. We constantly seem to back China and Russia in the UN. We antagonize America's allies, particularly Israel. When not speaking in the foreign policy context, it's all down with American imperialism and death to the Western capitalist pigs from the ANC. So is it any wonder that when the U.S. actually realized how the ANC feels about it, that it doesn't really regard us as non-aligned, which is exactly the reason why we're in this relationship trouble with the U.S. It's, you know, the BC Jonas here kind of seems to describe the relationship problems with the U.S. as just some kind of blip. It's just, you know, it's just like a little misunderstanding, basically, which seems to have been government's response overall. But that's just not in touch with reality. The problems and the differences between us are real. And you can't just sort of say, well, you know, we'll give you no tariffs on our pork and then everything will be fine. Chris, your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I think South Africa has in many ways been practicing active alignment, not non-alignment. That's part of probably the biggest part of the problem and the breakdown. The relationship with the US. The point around sort of the US being very transactional, and Jonas saying, look, there's a longer history here. I mean, many countries like China as well, they are transactional in their foreign policy. They might just go about it in a different kind of way. So what Trump is also doing, I think, in many ways for US foreign policy and geopolitical positioning is being very openly transactional, but it is similar to what other countries like China do as well. China might just do it more, try and do it more covertly. And if you as South Africa talk about being neutral and non-aligned, you have to realize that's reality. It's not how you wish things were, that you can fall back on the supposed history of warm feelings and shared values and all that kind of thing. That's not the reality that you're dealing with now. So number one, to just deal with that and try and mitigate in some kind of way less damage from the tariffs, for example, or to negotiate other kinds of short-term investments and trade between South Africa and the US, as one should be doing as the special envoy. But number two, for the longer term, it is not in South Africa's benefit and in the ANC's benefit to assume that should that now once President Trump's second term runs out, you know, assume the Democrats win for the next 100 years, which, you know, you and I will can talk for many hours about the organizational challenges facing the Democrats. Assume they can win. That doesn't fix then these deeper issues between South Africa and the US from a trade, foreign policy, values, nowadays values point of view. So it doesn't equip South Africa in the right kind of way to deal with the situation now, nor does it equip South Africa to deal with how the relationship with the US, I think, is going to continue to evolve, whether it's a Republican or Democrat president. It's going to be more openly transactional. I think there's going to be more of a focus from the US, from both parties, on more domestic issues. And how do trading partners deal with that? It doesn't help to then fall back into these, you know, talks of values and history and all that kind of thing. And also, I think a risk for the ANC specifically in terms of falling back into where it is more comfortable. So, for example, the Liberation Summit that was recently hosted, all these liberation movements where it's sort of, you know, sitting in a circle, holding each other close because, you know, the US is attacking you and it's neo-colonial and it's capital and all that kind of thing. It just doesn't help those governments or those people in those countries.
You can't be both a revolutionary liberation movement and a non-aligned power. this is, it's just like, you know, who are you liberating us from if not, you know, evil Western neocolonialism and imperialism, which is how the ANC talks all the time. I'm also particularly irritated by this sort of attack on ideological cliques and partisan political factions. I suppose that he's referring to people like us or people like AfriForum or even the DA for going and speaking to the Americans without government's approval. And you know, people like Johann Rupert as well, I think is possibly who he's mentioning when he says cabals of business people. Normally, the government is all very happy to throw a call everyone else counter-revolutionaries and traitors and accuse people of being working for the CIA and use like this incredibly overheated and aggressive rhetoric towards all of its domestic opponents. But when under pressure from overseas, suddenly it's all, oh no, everyone, we must stand together and be united. I mean, does the ANC, you know, sort of wonder why it's not able to win over some of these groups that are opposed to it with a call to national patriotism when it's something that it abuses so regularly? You know, I do think that there is an attitude out there, and I think our former colleague Sihle Ngubese has quite well explained this about how I do think there are some South Africans who are kind of rooting for the US to punish us in some way, and I don't think that's very productive. I don't think that's how we should be looking at things here. I think, you know, we must be hoping for the best. We don't want to live in a country with a collapsing economy where its export markets are decimated. But at the same time, people have only gotten to that point because the government has taken every opportunity to sort of put its thumb in their eye and antagonize them. And, you know, the ANC is sort of standing there now kind of going, but why is everyone being so mean after bullying everyone for many years? Do you have any thoughts on that, Chris?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point to highlight. I think that partly also explains why the ANC has leaned so much into the foreign policy space, because it doesn't want to acknowledge the consequences of its domestic policies. There's always something else to blame. And falling back into foreign policy gives you some of that comfort so that you're still the ANC of old, the sort of moral superpower that can is the only voice and force for oppressed people around the world, no matter what you've caused in your own country as a consequence, a natural consequence, it's a feature, not a bug, of the policies that you've chosen to implement is high unemployment, low growth, more inequality, and lower quality of life. I think we should also mention on part of Jonas's remarks, he also, and I haven't seen this in a while, so that's why I'm giving it the shout out, because it's quite, you know, it's playing the golden oldies, but he mentioned again the specter of white monopoly capital. And once that kind of thing gets rolled out, then I think you know what you're dealing with from an analysis point of view, from a positioning point of view. It really is, you know, bringing up the tropes in terms of when we're under attack, you know, we go back to the hits, as it were.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great example of this thing called the Mott and Bailey defense, which is a particularly irritating form of argument that a lot of public figures use. The idea is that you have the Bailey, which is like how you put the argument when you're not being challenged, which is we are the revolutionary advance guard of the vanguard of the up third world people who are going to overthrow the capitalist system. And then when you get attacked, you retreat to the moth and you say, oh no, we're just a non-aligned power. We just want what's best for everyone. You make the weak argument when you're not under attack, and then you retreat to a much smaller position and misrepresent what you were actually saying. And I think this is so typical of how the ANC has been approaching this. And it's all sort of, oh no, why is everyone being so mean to us? Everything is so terrible. Everyone is being unpatriotic, when at the same time it's calling people white monopoly capital, purposely impoverishing the people of this nation. Yeah, nah, pull the other one, dude. Okay, let's move on. I think we only have time for one more story, so we're not going to get to the political violence story. But let's talk a little bit about NERSA Electricity and Eskom's monopoly. So Eskom has gone to court challenging the national energy regulator NERSA's approval of 5 electricity trading licenses and 1 import-export license. And this has been criticized by a number of people, various consultants, people like Chris Yerland, accusing Eskom of basically just trying to hold on to its monopoly. Eskom has a whole bunch of reasons for why it's opposing the granting of these licenses. It's saying that it's unfair because these companies can pick and choose the most reliable and biggest clients and offer them lower tariffs, whereas Eskom has to provide electricity to everyone, even if they don't pay. And that these companies don't have the same redistributive obligations, and that by granting these licenses to these private distributors, the entire tariff structure of Eskom is being undermined, and that basically they're going to go bankrupt. Well, I think what Eskom is leaving out here is that Eskom also are the only ones who gets absolutely massive bailouts from government all the time, which have allowed it to continue existing long after it became dysfunctional and unprofitable. And this really is just Eskom, after for years saying that it was open to, you know, opening up the distribution market and agreeing to reform. In reality, it's not willing to do that. And it's opposing government policy. One of the few good changes in government policy in recent years has been the decision to open up the electricity distribution market. It's like the one win of the Ramaphosa administration. And now you have Eskom using its money to fight this in court. I don't know, Chris, what's your take on this?
And not even its money, but the money it's received in the form of bailouts, other forms of state assistance, ultimately taxpayer revenue, which has bailed out Eskom repeatedly to the tune of billions of rands. I mean, just earlier today, we had Parliament finalizing the Eskom Debt Relief Amendment Bill, which establishes the basis of a restructured debt support program. So even as that is happening, government again giving Eskom yet another lifeline, it is fighting for this kind of control. So it's one thing for a state entity to be rhetorically in favor of competition, but it's another thing that I think it wants to remain in control of the sort of macro structure, both in generation and in distribution. Because once you really start to open that up, you can probably still control it to some extent, give, you know, contracts to friends and you know, all that kind of thing. But it does open it up relatively more to competition than had been the case before. And Eskom already under such revenue strain, more and more customers trying to go off grid, municipalities owing Eskom this year probably more than 150 billion rand. So you're losing revenue from, you know, your quote-unquote customers, even though those customers don't have any other choices. But then also, you're trying to squeeze whatever you can out of the sort of system to make sure that you control it wherever possible. So, yeah, I think little surprise that that's been the sort of fallback position for Eskom. Now we'll see if there's real political will, both in NERSA and in cabinet from different ministries, to sort of hold a line on any kind of, you know, movement around competition and reform in that regard. Because if one doesn't, yeah, the incentive is also just there for Eskom to continue as it has done before. Now, to give credit, the energy availability factor has picked up in the last year. So in some ways, the coal fleet is being managed better. But Eskom continues to benefit from burning coal. It's not as it's not exposed to market forces like a normal company should be. So if this legislative change isn't pursued and pushed through like it should be, just from an incentive point of view, there's no reason to think Eskom is going to fix its distribution model, use taxpayer resources and bailouts responsibly, and actually provide cheap, reliable electricity that one would expect in a more competitive market, when there are competitive forces forcing Eskom to make better operational decisions, because then it can't rely on bailouts ad infinitum.
Right, exactly. They had their chance with their monopoly, and it has been squandered. And I don't think the public should trust that, you know, just because we haven't had load shedding for a while, that, oh no, it's, everything's fine, Eskom can remain as it was with no changes to the market. You know, basically, the problem of Eskom's profitability should not really, at the end of the day, be our problem. This is a problem for managers and politicians to solve, not for them to just crush competition and say, well, you know, we're going to just keep the status quo forever. Okay, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. And that's a wrap. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.